chance to get together and have some interaction, ask questions, and go a little deeper into what we're talking about on Sunday mornings. And last fall, we did it on the first two chapters of the book of Colossians. So we're going to continue that and finish that book this morning and the next five Sunday mornings, and we'll finish chapters 3 and 4, and we'll finish that book. And again, there are papers, a list of our small groups in the back. Take a look at it. See if you can find a time and a place that would work for you. And again, like Mike said, it's just a six-week commitment, a month and a half. Make that commitment. I'm sure that you're not going to regret it. Let's take a look at this now. Third chapter of Colossians. We're going to read the first 11 verses out of that. And while you're finding that, Colossians 3, verses 1 through 11, if you want to follow along with me, I want to just kind of remind you a little bit the theme that's kind of ringing through this book, what Paul is trying to drive home. We talked about it in the fall, but it's been a while, so let me just kind of remind you again that the whole thing that Paul is really trying to get us to understand is the sufficiency of Jesus, that Jesus is everything, he's enough. We don't need to add anything to who Jesus is. If we just understand Jesus himself and the character of Jesus, we'll be good. And one of the examples that I used in that was to try and imagine the net worth of Bill Gates, which is pretty unbelievable to imagine. I looked it up. I remember last fall, it's probably increased since then, but at that point it was $80 billion. So imagine if somehow you inherited his net worth and you received his $80 billion. That would be pretty amazing. But what would be pretty crazy is if you said, you know what, that's awesome. I got Bill Gates $80 billion. Now all I need to really be happy in addition to that $80 billion would be that $80 billion and this microphone. Then I'll be happy. That's what it's like with Jesus. If we're like, well, Jesus is okay, but if I could have Jesus and, that's even more crazy than saying that about your inheritance from Bill Gates. And that's what the Colossians were doing. They were taking Jesus, who was sufficient and enough, and they were adding things to it. And that's how cults start. That's how new religions start, when you take Jesus and you start adding things to it. So Paul is just trying to get them to understand, you don't need to add. He's enough. And he continues to just hammer on that theme in Colossians chapter 3. So let's just look at these 11 verses. We're going to go into them a little bit this morning, and then hopefully in your small groups this week, you'll have a chance to look at it even a little more and discuss it. Paul writes, "Since then, you've been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God." See how everything's Christ? Set your hearts on Christ. You've been raised with Christ. Verse 2, "Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things." So he asked you to set your hearts on things above, and now to set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. Verse 3, "For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life," that's your life. Christ is your life, not your career, not all these other things. It's good to remind yourself what Paul is reminding us right now. Verse 4, "When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory." Verse 5, "Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived, but now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on your new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Here, in this place, there is no Greek or Jew, circumcised, uncircumcised, barbarians, Scythians, slave or free, but Christ is all and in all. Christ is all. Christ is all you need. So I'm going to kind of look at this, and I want to look at three things anyway that we could maybe extract out of this and look at it a little deeper, and then you can go into them deeper and even other things perhaps that you'll see when you discuss this and have a chance to ask questions back. That's what I like about preaching. You guys don't have a chance to ask me those hard questions that I don't know how to answer. But in the small groups, you can do that, you know. But we're going to just look at this. The first thing that I want to look at is how Jesus brings radical change. Now, we've heard that, but I think it's important for us to be reminded of that. Jesus brings not just change, radical change to our lives. So it's an important thing to understand that He can radically change our lives. He can continue to radically change our lives. But not only that, but it's important that we understand how He does that. How does He change us? You know, people all want to change. There's all kinds of self-help seminars going out there because people want to change. There's all this self-improvement seminars, these motivational speakers that are out there. I looked up who's the big guy in that department, Tony Robbins. He made $30 million in 1 year because people want to change. They want to know that they can not just stay where they're at, but things can change. They can do better. They can go to a peak performance coach and find change in their life. People want to change. Well, the gospel tells us if you want change, you can experience radical change through the gospel. And it begins to tell us how those changes take place. Thirdly, why does it work? Why, if we really, truly understand the gospel, to understand why it works then, how it works, but why does it work? And I think if we can get those questions a little more answered, we'll begin to understand and hopefully experience more of the radical change that the gospel promises us. So we're going to look at these things. And to start, I just want to look at the first thing that Paul says about radical change. So number one, it radically changes you. Jesus brings radical change in your life. Paul puts it in pretty radical language or terms. He says this, verses 9 and 10, since you have taken off your old self, and then he goes on to say, and have put on your new self. Paul says that this is such a radical change. It's not like you're just putting off certain beliefs and certain behaviors or practices and then putting on other ones, but he's saying that when you really believe in Jesus, really believe your view and practices of things change so much that you actually become a different person. He says it's such a radical change that he uses the terminology that you actually become a new person, a completely another person. And one of the distinctions or one of the things that I think Paul understood that brought radical change was that it wasn't just religion, a religious experience, but it was a real spiritual experience. Religion has a way of changing people. It can, but it's more superficial, isn't it? It's more from the outside. Maybe it's certain dress. Maybe it's the way you talk. Maybe you don't listen to certain things or certain music, or you don't watch certain things. But what happens is, if it's just done from the outside, all we do is we kind of create a religious subculture, a group of people that are gathered around certain practices, doing things a certain way, but there's no real internal change that's really take place. Paul knew about that firsthand. Paul had experienced religious change, but he also experienced genuine internal spiritual change himself. And he even could understand that there could almost be like a misunderstanding of true spiritual change that didn't take place, but maybe you would think it would take place, but it's not. All it really did was the religious training, in his case even, and in a lot of people's cases, in the Pharisees' case, is it only made them more smug and judgmental. It's the only real changes it made. It made them more self-righteous. Mark Twain, who was kind of a cynic when it came to religious things, had this to say what he felt religion did to people. He said this, it says, it kind of made them become a good man in the worst sense of the word. We say the best man in the best sense of the word. He said they would become the worst kind of, in the best sense of the word. They would do all the right things, but even though they were doing all the right things, it actually made them worse people. Paul understood that. And in fact, Paul knew that's what he was at one point. But after an encounter with Jesus, he had a whole new venture. He saw that the old self was put away. There was a new person that was welling up within him. His faith was now making him different, not just from the outside, not just from his practices, but the way he understood true transformation now was not that he was more pious, but that he was becoming more joyous, more humble, more compassionate, more and more loving. And these were the things that he really could look at his markers to see whether God was really changing his life. Lots of times when we look to religious markers to make us change, it really just kind of makes us weird. It doesn't really make us change in any real sense of the word. Paul is saying the changes that belief in Jesus made in him were not just external distinguishing marks so that they could create another religious subculture, but he's actually becoming a different person, a new person from the inside. And he's saying that these changes were actually not only bringing in good things, but it was getting rid of the bad things. And he goes on to say it made him a completely different person, that other things were falling by the wayside. In the next section, he mentions it. Yes? Oh, how does he change us? So he talks about how is he going to change us? How do these things happen? How do all these things fall by the wayside? And he says this. He says the key to it, the key to change is this, being heavenly minded. Putting your mind on things above and not things below. Here's how he says it in verses 1 and 2. He says, set your hearts on things above. Set your mind on things above, not on earthly things, which is really kind of the exact opposite of what we hear around in the world, isn't it? That kind of terminology is almost kind of looked down on. Heavenly mindedness, you got your head in the clouds, what is it? You're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. What are the phrases that we use when we really want to say somebody is, you know, got their act together? There's somebody that you can talk to and you're going to get good advice. We say, well, they're just down to earth. We don't say, you know, they're heavenly minded. Say, well, they're down to earth. They're well grounded. You know, you got their feet on the ground. They're in touch with reality because their feet are on the ground. They're well grounded. They're down to earth. You can talk to them. But Paul is saying, nope, it's just the opposite. He said, if somebody's really got their act together, they're not going to just be down to earth, well grounded on the earth. If you understand it in the true sense of the word, he says the ones that are really going to have their act together and understand it are going to be the ones who are heavenly minded. Because they're not just understanding a part of reality, they're beginning to understand all of reality. See, if all we're looking at is here, we've only got a small part of the picture, but if we can understand the whole picture, we get all of reality, not just a part of reality,
by understanding this, what you see isn't all you get. So we read on from verse 5. You see that once that you're heavenly minded, not only are you going to be able to understand things better, but you're going to be able to put off things. It actually does make you a better person. He says, if you've got your focus on heaven, you're not going to just understand a part of reality, you're going to understand all of reality. These things are going to begin to fall by the wayside. You're going to be able to put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, greed, which is idolatry. These things are going to fall by the wayside. Then he goes on and he says, you also be able to rid yourself, and you must rid yourselves of all such things as these. Anger, rage. Notice these are internal attitudes too. Not just outward practices, malice, slander, filthy language from your lips. Now, all of that follows the prerequisite that heavenly mindedness has to come first. First, he talks about heavenly mindedness. Then he talks about being able to get rid of these other things. That's the order that it's no accident that he wrote it in that way, but that's the order in which it's got to come. If you get your mind on heaven, then you've got the ability to get rid of things that are not so good that come here from earth. But how does that work? How does heavenly mindedness help us to rid ourselves of the things of this earth that hinder us, that keep us from going forward? You know what I think? You ever think about some of the stories that are considered some of the best stories, or movies that are considered some of the best movies? It always is somebody who's got, or often, not always, but a lot of the great stories and movies are the ones where it's somebody who's just got an ordinary life, you know, live in an ordinary area, and then something kind of whisks them away and takes them into another dimension, right? And then all of a sudden, from that other dimension, they're able to see things from a completely different perspective, and they see a truer reality of the way things really are from that other dimension. Then when that ordinary person who has been kind of whisked away to be able to look at things from another perspective, from that other dimension, when they come back into their own place, all of a sudden they're a changed person, aren't they? They're larger than life. They laugh at things they never used to laugh at. They cry easier. They're just like a new freedom and a power. They understand the bigger reality of all those things, right? That's what they are. I mean, that's what Ebenezer Scrooge, right? In the Christmas, he's taken to another dimension, and by being able to look at things from a bigger perspective, a larger perspective, he sees things completely different, and it changes him. Of course, my favorite is It's a Wonderful Life, right? He feels like his life has just been a complete sham. It's been a waste. He's done nothing but make a failure of his life, make a failure of other people's lives, and he just wants his life to be over. He asks God to make his life be over, and then what does God do? God sends an angel, takes him, and lets him see things from another dimension, as if George Bailey had never been born. And then all of a sudden, he sees things completely different. When he comes back, he's got a whole nother attitude, a whole nother perspective on life. And Paul is saying, if we can understand that, we can get that same perspective. If we'll be heavenly minded, we'll get the bigger picture. We can see that there's another dimension, and even be able to see things from another dimension, that somehow they come together. And then he goes on and he says this. He says, since then, you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above. And Christians are people who live with their mind, being able to just remind yourself that there's a bigger and there's a greater reality. That this isn't it. Paul got that perspective and he said, you know what? If God is for us, who can be against us? His eyes were opened, And he was able to understand the fuller reality of everything. But you've got to understand from the other perspective, understanding there's another realm. From a heavenly-minded perspective, you live with a greatness, just a whole new confidence with things from being heavenly-minded. You've been raised with Christ. That means that, as we often say, he lived the life you should have lived. He died the death that you should have died. And therefore, all you have to do is receive it. But he uses the word since. Since this is true, you have a whole greater perspective of everything. See things from another dimension. The only legitimate reason, really, when you think about this, if it's really true, how about the thing if there is a whole, it's so much bigger than what we see here, and we believe it from a heavenly mindedness. We believe there's something so much greater. This is only the first inch on a cord that goes on for eternity, that God's got so much more. Do we really believe that? If we really believe it, it changes the way we totally handle all of life. You know, I've told you that example where, let's say you get two people and they both have the exact same job. They both have to go to work. They work in the same room. They both have to build the same widget, whatever that involves, okay? You put this thing on that thing and whatever. And all the conditions are exactly the same. The only difference is one of them has been told at the end of the year, you'll get paid $10,000. The other person has been told at the end of the year, you'll get paid $1 billion. Nothing has changed in the work conditions or the circumstances. Only their perspective and what they know is waiting for them. If we really believe a heavenly mindedness that there's so much more than what we have here, it will change everything. That's why it changed people like George Bailey to see a different perspective, to know. I think the only good excuse for somebody not wanting to receive Jesus as Lord is to simply say, you know what, it's too good to be true. So, brings radical change. But why does it work? Why does it work? There's a concept that I think is so important, is that it doesn't just remove things, it replaces things in our life. In other words, you can't just get rid of stuff. Once you get rid of it, it needs to be replaced. Didn't Jesus kind of say that? It's kind of like a spiritual principle. Back in Matthew chapter 12, he said this. He said, when an evil spirit comes out of a man, it goes through arid places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to the house I left. When it arrives, it finds the house unoccupied, swept clean, and put in order. Then it goes and takes with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself. And they go in and live there, and the final condition of that man is worse than the first. That is how it will be with the wicked generation. You can't just get rid of stuff. Paul says to get rid of stuff, you know, get rid of all malice and anger and immorality. But the thing is we can't just get rid of these things. Let's look at it. Verse 5, that's what he says. He says, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed. And then he makes this interesting final comment. He says, which is idolatry. What's interesting also here is the word for evil desires. The Greek word for evil desires does not necessarily just mean a desire for bad things. In fact, that same Greek word is used when Paul lists these same lusts of the flesh in Galatians 5, but the way it's translated there is it just says desire. It's not necessarily a desire for bad things. It's an inordinate desire for anything more than God. Which means it could just be an excessive desire, an over desire for something that could even be good. In a way, isn't that what sexual immorality is? Sex is a great thing, but an over desire for it brings you outside the boundaries that God has given us for this great gift, and then it becomes something terrible. But it doesn't always end up that way. It's just that we have to understand that we can desire things more than we can desire God. The thing is that the way we're wired is that we have to adore something. There's got to be something that's central in your life, whether it's your career, whether it's a relationship, whether it's your golf game, you know, whatever. And there's nothing wrong with those things, but if that becomes the central driving force, then you've become subject to this epithumia is what the word is, epithumia, I think. I try and pronounce these things, you know. Go on the thing where it clicks and then it pronounces it for you on the computer. Then I forget how it said it afterwards, you know. Epithumia, I think, is what it said. But it means an over-desire, inordinate desire for these things, a desire, a passion that only is supposed to be reserved for God. So you can take a good thing. That's how Keller puts it. You can take a good thing and make it an ultimate thing, and then it becomes idolatry. And that's why Paul says, these are all idolatry. Because it's an inordinate desire for things, and they could even be good things. Doing bad things is not necessarily what makes you lost. The Pharisees didn't do anything bad, did they? They did it all right, yet Jesus said they were lost. When we have an inordinate, when our priorities are out of place, old preacher back from the 18th century into the early 19th century, a guy from Scotland, said this is the only way that you can get rid of stuff, because if you get rid of it, like Jesus said, and you don't replace it, then you'll just end up replacing it eventually with something even worse. If we get rid of something that's taken an inordinate place in our life, and it's an idol, and we get rid of it, if we don't replace it with God, we'll just replace it with another idol. Because of how we're wired, we can't eliminate God without replacing Him with God substitutes. That's just the way we're wired. We have to have something that gives us identity that we're all about, you know, whether it's the New York Giants or the Detroit Lions, you know, and all of that is okay, but if that's what you're all about, then it's taken the place of where God is supposed to be in your life. See, God has given us this desire where we're wired to have something. So what Paul is saying is if you're heavenly minded, that gives you the ability to get rid of that thing that's taking the centrality of your life and make God the center of your life. Because something's got to be there. Here's how this old preacher from Scotland put it. He said, the only way to dispossess the heart of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. You've got to find something that is a greater passion than your old passion to replace it. And ultimately, that place is reserved, is supposed to be for Jesus. And that's what Paul says, that's all you need. That's where he's supposed to be, in the center of your life. I read an interesting example about a lady who had gone through such, she talked about how she had gone through so many just abusive relationships with men. And she realized it was because she got all of her significance, her acceptability, and her identity from men. She had to have, it was about having a successful relationship with a man. And because of that, she would end up submitting herself to terrible physical abuse because she needed that approval of the man too much. It was central in her life. It was the ultimate thing in her life. It was in the middle. Finally, she became a Christian, and God took that center place, and she went to go get counseling just for further healing on the whole issue. But wasn't a Christian counselor, so it was kind of interesting what the Christian counselor, or what the non-Christian counselor had told her. That she told her that, you know what, it's good that you got rid, and she understood this principle, that you can't just get rid of something and not replace it. But now that you've understood that that was an inordinate desire, that you were placing your significance, your identity, your acceptability on a relationship with a man, now you've gotten rid of that, now you need to replace that. And what you need to do is go get a good education and get yourself a good career. Which is true. I mean, you give yourself esteem. But the thing is that she was basically telling her to get rid of one idol and replace it with another idol. Really what she was saying is saying get rid of the idol that is an idol to many women, a man, and replace it with the idol that is an idol to many men, a job. But she came to the place that she kind of saw through it because her mind was focused on heaven. And realizing that the only thing that deserves that place in my life is Jesus Christ. And I'm thankful if another man comes into my life and I'd like to be married, but that isn't the defining thing in my life. Jesus is the defining thing in my life. That's what matters most. That's what I'm going to be leaning on. That's what I'm going to look for. That's what Paul said in verse 4 of chapter 3 that Christ is your life. Christ is your life. If you make the career your life, man, you know what? You can fail the career, and guess what? They'll fire you. You can fail Jesus, and he'll die for you. And you know, it's not like a new, profound truth, but I think sometimes we just have to be reminded of it. We have to bring those truths before us and just remind ourselves. I was talking to Arlene the other day and I was saying, you know, sometimes I think even me as a pastor, you wonder like, well, you know, what does it really do? You know, we come here and we listen to another message, another Sunday, and then not only you, I'll tell you the truth, in a couple weeks, I have to go look back up and see what I spoke about 2 weeks ago. You know, and it's like, well, is this really changing anybody? Is it really doing any good? One thing that I saw that really helped me is, let me ask you this. Who could tell me what you had for dinner 2 weeks ago on Friday? See, I knew somebody was going to do that. I knew it. All right, forget it. I won't do the example then. No, but you know what I mean? You could go back. How many people could really name all the meals we ate for the last month, right? We're not going to be able to do it, but you know what? If we didn't eat for the last year, you'd be dead. And it's not really that you remember everything, but it becomes part of you. It nourishes you for that moment, and you are able to go. I think lots of times that's what it is with spiritual food. We need to just continue to nourish ourselves. And we can't always remember what we got specifically, but it becomes part of us. And we keep our minds focused on heaven and understand that Jesus, as Paul said, is your life. I love how he ends this down by verse 10 when he just says this, put on the new self. It's a new self, the new you, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. And he says there's no class system. He just concludes the section saying, you know what, it doesn't matter who's from what or where. It doesn't matter if you're barbarian, Scythian, a Jew or Greek, we're all one in Christ Jesus. Because Christ is our identity. Christ is what's central. Christ is what we need. And we get all these other things that take the center, and all they do is take us down. Making Christ the center. So I hope you'll take some time this week and just think about this. Go to your small groups. One thing that's sometimes good to just ask ourselves, you know, they have a way of creeping into the middle again.
You know, I have to ask myself, how important is my ministry as opposed to Jesus Christ? Yeah, it's a challenging thing. You know, it's one thing to say, well, is your career most important? Well, there's a way that ministry can become a career rather than a ministry. And if the church just plummeted and something happened, you know, you hear about these things, and that was it. Would it be devastating? Yes. The question is, would it be paralyzing? It's a good thing, but if it's an ultimate thing, it'll destroy your life. And we have to be careful that nothing is in that place except Jesus Christ, because everything else is subject to change or death. It's important to remind ourselves of that. And I hope you do that this week. Find a group. Come on, it's only 6 weeks. You ought to be able to work it out. I know you're busy, but you're really that busy? And if you are, maybe it's an idol. Ah, wow. So check it out now. Come on. All right, let's pray. Let's pray. Father, we just thank you, Lord, that you have such patience.